be here without you. I'd be somewhere else. Well, this is a pleasure, and it's really nice to see all these smiling faces. Some maybe even a little older than I am, but not too many. And it's a pleasure to reminisce with you about a fun time in the early 70s in particular, when a lot of interesting things happened. A lot of things were possible that weren't possible even a few years before that. And I feel very fortunate to have been alive at that particular time and place in history. So think back to 1970. There were a bunch of young PhDs who thought that they knew everything and that everything was possible. Nothing was impossible. It's pretty typical for the 20s, for your 20s, I suppose. And it turns out, like many people, later we learned that we didn't know very much at that time, but we managed to accomplish some things anyway. So here are some things we did. And all of this was made possible by timing, by a fortuitous collection of events. Most of you know the story of Xerox PARC, I'm sure. But it was founded in 1970 with a mandate that had something to do with the Office of the Future, or more particularly a speech made by the then chairman, Peter McCullough, who talked about the architecture of information. We're going to be the leaders and the pioneers in the architecture of information. And we didn't know what the hell that meant, but it sounded pretty darn interesting. Turned out that Peter didn't know either. Some speechwriter had written that for him, but he had the cojones to go out and say it and mean it. And Xerox struggled with that for a long time, but the landmark, the stake they put in the ground was Xerox PARC. Arguably turned out a lot of good things. So it was 1970, and we had this charter. A bunch of good people had come there. I felt fortunate to be included, in fact. And one of the first things that my manager said to me was, I know you're interested in this and this, and you did these cellular arrays, blah, 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 you did some graphics. We're trying to build a laboratory here that has some very quality themes. Why don't you take a year to figure out what exactly you should do? Great. That was wonderful. I've never heard those words since. Usually it's more like, why don't you take a day to think about what you should have done a year ago? Anyway, that was a wonderful gift. It didn't take me a year at all to figure out that I wanted to build a frame buffer. What's a frame buffer? It's just a bunch of memory that holds a picture. And one of the fortuitous events was a small company, young company named Intel, that was then producing integrated memories, had decided that they could produce a chip that had the incredible capacity of a kilobit. In fact, they made one that had a capacity of a kilobit in a dynamic RAM form, random access form, and also more or less the same time one that was two 1K shift registers for a total of 2K bits in shift register form. And that one was in a chip that only had 8 pins. So the density was high, cost per bit was low. And this, of course, made possible lots of things. Eventually the Alto, we built a PDP-10 equivalent called Max. And we used some of these chips in the SuperPaint system. And for the first time, we could afford and manage enough memory in one place to do a frame buffer, a frame of approximately television resolution imagery. So that made a lot of things possible. And I'll tell you a little bit about what we built. Oh, I have to apologize that we were not able to get the real SuperPaint running. It may have seen its last boot, I don't know. It almost boots. If we have anyone here who is an expert in Diablo 31 disk drives, controllers, and that 1970s technology, I'd definitely like to talk to you. And if anyone can read disk packs of that variety, RPO5 Diablo disk packs, 2 megabytes, and 8 sectors, gentlemen right here. Does anyone have one in their car? No? Sold to this gentleman right here. I'd like to talk to you, sir. We may resurrect it yet again, but I have a partial simulation running on the Windows PC. Albie has a recreation of his New York Tech paint program running on the PC, which he will tell you about. And these things will be remembered, I suppose, in that form. But we can go see Super Paint in the collection in a little while. You may get bored by this talk, but please don't miss the collection. Okay? There's a ton of great stuff. There's 22 tons of great stuff over there. And don't miss it. Okay, so my friend Pierre Saint-Hilaire says, we have to do it while it still seems crazy. I love this. I love this guy. What was interesting about the Super Paint hardware? Well, there was a full frame of video, 640 by 480, 486 actually. Those of you who know video know that 480 lines isn't technically enough. 2K shift registers, the Intel 24-1 recirculating. One big long shift register. Entire frame of 8 bits per pixel. 83 nanosecond pixel clock makes it square pixels. Two color tables, each 256 by 3 by 8. And two sets of three D to A's. Originally we had intended to do two full frames, but the powers that be deemed that too expensive, so we just had one, but we had two sets of outputs. So I made two pictures and displayed them on two monitors. One became the menu, the other the canvas, and each was 4 bits per pixel. This was, I think, the first frame buffer to have full NTSC video compatibility, including genlocking. It had an NTSC encoder, it had its own little sync generator, and those of you know about display controllers, you can do a phase lock loop, or you can actually start and stop the entire data chain, and we did the latter, start and stop the entire data chain, including all 8 phases of some humongous clock. It's like a centipede putting all its feet down before it can stop and then picking them up again, so that it could genlock to anything, no matter how much jitter and what the time discontinuities were. Real-time continuous video input. About that time, there became available a box for $12,000 that digitized at a video rate 8 bits. This thing had a Nova 800 controller. This was before the Alto was invented, but not much. And it had X run-coded hardware for reading and writing. It's the only thing that made it really work with the long shift registers. By far, the most contentious decision, of course, was to use the shift registers as opposed to RAMs in this machine. But they were so much cheaper, so much denser, and the bandwidth was so much easier to get out of them that a little napkin calculation showed that if we had some X run code hardware so that the Nova could write a position and a run color and a run length on every scan line 63 microseconds, so that's not hard, we could go blazingly fast, and for simple things, flat objects, flat color objects, we could go faster than the Alto or anything at the time that was running dynamic RAMs. But of course, the worst case, you had to wait for the pixel to come all the way around the whole frame time, 16 milliseconds, to get to it. So random access was pretty much out of the question. It had color replace and the X part of area fill in the hardware as well, although no one ever used it except me and my test programs. here's what the data paths look like. The pinkish-purple here is the main path where data comes out of the frame buffer and is recirculated back in again continually, and of course it also goes out to the displays. And we could throw these multiplexers at a pixel rate so that video in could be digitized at any pixel pattern on the screen. Then the Nova run code interface also came into that. So the whole idea was real-time. You've got to play with the recirculation of the display. It's not like a buffer where you store things and somebody else is displaying from them. This was much more coupled and sort of an interesting architecture from which we learned a lot, although I wouldn't have recommended it in general then or certainly now. Here's what the menu looked like. A confusing jumble of icons, if I ever saw one. Let's look at that. Painting and color functions. Down here we have the paint brushes. They could be multicolor like this one. 16 colors in the palette. When you selected one, a little arrow appeared, as I've shown here. This box means get a color from the picture, from the canvas, like the eyedropper in today's programs. Push this button for painting. Then up here we've got the color sliders. Albi did the color space, hue, saturation, and brightness conversion here. and that color space transform. When you press the HSB label, it changes to red, green, blue interpretation on the sliders and so on. Pretty straightforward, kind of embarrassingly crude. Here's some file functions. Load from the disk to the picture memory, load with the colors rather than using the ones that are there already. There's some color map and color space mapping problems and allocation problems already here. Write to the disk, write to the disk in a form that could be printed. Gary Starkweather had just built the first laser printers, in particular a color version of the laser printer, because Xerox had manufactured a ton of color copier engines, but decided that the world didn't want them pretty much, and so they had a warehouse full of these things. It was easy to get a laser head on a color copier for a while, and we had the luxury of color copies. various simple imaging functions, scale up, scale down. There's only 16 colors to work with here, so we're not doing any anti-aliasing or filtering anything, of course. This is copy, and this is move, that is to say, copy and erase the original. Animation functions. We've explored color table animation quite a lot. My partner Damon and I in particular, I'll show you some of his stuff in a second. Basically, there were two palettes, a foreground palette and a background palette, or a palette 1 and palette 2. You could switch between them, and you could set them independently, and then one at a time step the colors from one into the other, or interpolate between colors, or you could turn them on in sequence and leave them on. We call that reveal, and then good old-fashioned cycling colors, where you're simply moving colors through the palette space. I'll show you some examples. What else? Miscellaneous functions, text, sort of a simple character generator with a couple of fonts in there. Video in, you could video into an arbitrary area of the picture in real time, but it was monochrome input, of course. And make a brush out of any shape you had painted, draw some lines, set the gridding for positioning. Area filling was written by Patrick Baudelaire, and this one was, I think, replace color in an area or something like that. And this was erase a rectangular area. People sometimes say, oh, you made the first frame buffer or the first paint program or something like that. I really didn't do either of those things, and there were a number of important developments prior to SuperPaint that were inspirational and that ought to be recognized and frequently aren't. The Alto came to life about two months or less prior to SuperPaint's displaying its first picture, and it had a bitmap display, single bit per point bitmap display, as you know, and there was shortly after that, lots of graphics programs by various people, including Alan Kay and his group. Even prior to that, there was a character generator paint program at Park, so this wasn't the first Park paint program. Frame buffer. There was a frame buffer based on shift registers, and soon one on RAMs, based on RAMs by the Ramtech Corporation, already on the market at that point, but it was pretty lame. The paint program by Nolan Miller at Bell Labs, where they used the memory of the DDP 225, I think is about the first paint program that I ever saw or was aware of personally. Tricolor Cartograph by Kubitz at the University of Illinois was using a disk based frame memory and drawing things into it quite early. And my real inspiration for being in computer graphics at all was a wonderful guy named Lee Harrison, who died recently, who was doing real-time rescan analog animation in the mid-60s, and did some amazing stuff, which was on TV for a while. Let's go look at a couple of pictures while we're at it. Where would I find that? Maybe right here, yeah. Here's the back panel. Got a few problems in that system so far. Memory cards to the left and the right with the shift register. Memory chips, those were printed circuit boards, and then there were three or four multiplexer data path cards in the center, which were wire-wrapped Auget cards. Here's what the rack looked like. One of the two racks, the Nova you can see in the other rack, but this is the rack that had SuperPaint in it. Here's the memory back panel that you just saw. Then the rack about to go in just below that has all the control and the interfaces to the Nova and the D to A's and inputs and outputs and stuff. And then there was going to be a second rack of memory down here. Big honking fans right here, and a power supply that's, you know, hundreds of amps at 5 volts down here. This is the A to D converter up here. This entire box is an 8-bit A to D. Here's the first picture it ever displayed. Well, it was the 70s, okay? The sign says, it works, sort of. This was before the Nova interface was even working. This was just real-time video going through the buffer. And I held up this card late at night in front of a camera, and I pulled the clip lead off of the back panel with my knees to get it to capture this frame. And since it had no interface, and I didn't want to lose this precious picture, I had to plug in the Nova interface card, undebugged with the power on, and debug it and its software and the interface, the complete interface to the Nova, excluded a whole bunch of stuff, without losing this picture. And it sort of did that, but you can see lots of bad pixels, and I ran a heuristic program on it which figured out what some of the bad ones were. But that was the first picture. Then I did some anti-aliasing, what you would call anti-aliasing today. I called it jagger removal or something at that time. I didn't really know much about sampling theory or any of that. But I simulated what a TV camera does. That is to say, there's a finite spot or a disk scans across the edge, and more of it is occluded. It's just a simple computation to figure out how much of that it is. And without understanding it deeply, I was able to get pretty good results. You can see all of these spokes look more or less the same at arbitrary angles. And this was before anybody started painting anything on the system. Here's two sets of lines. One of these sets of lines is actually ink on paper viewed by a video camera, and the other set of lines is coming out of the system. And they're put together by video. And probably you can tell pretty easily that the bottom set is the set on the paper, because the paper isn't completely flat, so they're kind of bent. But I thought that looked pretty good. And then Bob Plagel did some terrific drawings, which we smoothed. And some of you at least can see the jaggies on the left and the smooth lines on the right. So this was 74, 75-ish, late 73, early 74, I think. We had a lot of visitors at Park, and one day we had a performance artist, an artist, period, coming from Iowa, come and visit us. He gave us a mind-blowing multi-screen presentation which featured everything he'd ever done, including sculptures. It had nude photos of his wife. It had drawings. It had natural art. It had all kinds of strange things. He took one look at the system, went back to Iowa, packed his bags, and came to Palo Alto. Took a job with a guard company and got a job being the night guard at Park. He claims this was all actually accidental, that he got this particular job and so on. I don't know. He's got some powers that we don't have, maybe. But anyway, his name is Fritz Fischer. Some of you might know him. And during the night when he was guarding, he would come around to paint once in a while. And we'd come in the morning and things like this would greet us. The funny part is this is 256 colors, or all 8 bits, and the run code hardware wasn't working yet, so brushes could be of any height, but only 1 pixel wide. That's a challenge, I guess. Let's see. A terrific artist and designer named Bill Bowman decided he wanted to do an animation of the laser scanner that Gary Starkweather was building. And about that time, we acquired a one-frame-at-a-time recording video disc, like an instant replay-type disc, 4 channels of analog video times 300 frames. And even though the tools were incredibly crude, the paint program was really pretty crude at that time, Bill sat there and painted a number of frames of this cycle animation, which I'll show you. This slot animation, scanned laser output terminal is the acronym, which I'll show you on video in a little while. So that was the first frame-by-frame animation. Let's see, you've seen the menu. KQED the PBS station in San Francisco got interested, heard that we were doing something exceedingly weird, and some people came down to take a look at it. And among them was a guy named Damon Rary, who is a terrific graphic artist and animator. And we began to collaborate on this stuff, and Damon produced graphics for this television series called Over Easy with Hugh Downs that was running, originating KQED in those days. And Damon and I went on to collaborate on lots of other things. In particular, we got asked to come over to Ames, over there. Is that the right direction? During Pioneer Venus in 1978. The Pioneer mission to Venus had no imaging on board. A lot of scientific instruments, but they weren't going to get any pictures, at least not any real-time or near-time pictures. And so they were desperate for some way to explain this to the public and make it interesting rather than having the scientists stand up and talk about their dry data. So thanks to a terrific PR guy named Pete Waller, we brought the entire Superpaint system over here and set it up near the press room and near Mission Control for Pioneer Venus. And Damon did a whole bunch of animations and things, which I will show you, for Pioneer Venus. And we fed them live to NASA TV, and they were seen pretty much around the world at that time. During the encounter, here's one of those graphics. This is, by the way, an actual scan picture of video scan picture of Venus taken by another spacecraft, Mariner spacecraft, which we colored and put in place there. You'll see all of these. One of the probes landed and then quickly stopped transmitting, so Dan and I thought maybe this is what happened to it. Let's see, why don't we go to some tape for a moment. I can push the proper buttons here. I actually don't know how I did this one, but it was all done in the system. Slightly different menu than what I showed a minute ago, a little earlier. Choose a color, choose a brush, and go over to the canvas and draw. There were several modes that you'll see illustrated here, including the two-monitor mode and the one-monitor mode where things were overlaid or switched onto a single monitor, which I could easily do because of the extra output. Okay, we don't need to see a great deal of detail about this. Draws a tree, draws some stuff. Makes a brush and draws all over the place with it. Demonstration of color changing. I think it was just red, green, blue axes at this point before Alvy did the transform. And I think we're going to do a little animation here. One nice thing is that you could set the speed and then you could continue to paint while it was cycling. Forward and backwards. If you go slow, it interpolates. That's the magic carpet effect there. Okay. Let's go ahead. There's a video in. Capture that little hand. The ever-popular bouncing ball demo. All the balls are in the picture, of course. Only one of them is turned to the foreground color, the pink color. The rest are white or background. So you can't see them. Of course, you could have two of them, or any number of them if you like. It's amazing how much you can get visually out of 10 animating colors and 6 fixed colors. Okay, let's skip over this. A bit more animation. Here's the slot animation. Frame at a time onto video disc. Here come the bits flying in there from the upper right, appearing on the drum. Various artists worked on the system at this point, including Alby. That was Alby's.
Beautiful.
Here's Pioneer Venus, Mission Control.
We're waiting now for word.
They're waiting for orbit insertion.
Roger that.
Okay, we have it. We have the communications now. We can hear
and
the
here's our animation.
The sonar probe. We're right on time.
Done by Damon. A lot of these we prepared in advance, but then there were various things that happened during the mission, during the encounter, and Damon was able to create graphics from elements he already had, or draw something, or change an animation to reflect what the scientists were actually learning, getting back from the probes, and that turned out to be really useful. In fact, we were invited back the following year, a year later, for Pioneer Saturn. 79. Okay. So we had a great deal of fun with that. And Damon and I went off to start a company called Aurora Systems to do this commercially. And we built some interesting systems and eventually had painting and animation systems installed at dozens and dozens of places around the world, TV stations and post-production houses and video producers, industrial video producers. For a while there, all the graphics that you saw on CNN and Turner and TBS Headline News, over-the-shoulder graphics, were coming from Aurora paint systems that were essentially descendants of this. Aurora wasn't a success ultimately as a business, but we had a lot of fun and did some interesting things. So backing up to the Xerox PARC story, at one point I had a visitor who I had met through our interest in mutual interest in cellular automata and mathematics. He was teaching at NYU at the time and had a very strong interest in art and in science and mathematics as well. And Alvy will tell you his story, but he became a very important part of the story of Superpaint and of my life from then on, in fact. And it was a distinct pleasure to win a couple of awards with him, and now he's going to tell you his part of the story. Let me get your...
What the cellular automata did accomplish for me other than Stanford. And I came up with two things. One was I got a cover on Scientific American. And second, it got me Dick Shout. He just sort of mentioned it that he met because of a mutual interest in parallel architectures. Mine was mathematical, called cellular automata theory. And I put together a conference at the National Computer Convention in Boston one year on that subject, and I looked around for somebody interesting to be on the panel who actually built hardware, and I was pointed by several different pointers to this freshman and a PhD student, Dick Shout, at CMU. We met, and we hit it off on all kinds of levels, technical, but mostly just friends. We've been solid friends ever since. Shortly after meeting, he takes off to join this outfit called Park, and he starts building this machine. It's something to do with art, and I couldn't figure out what he was talking about. You know, I was interested because I paint pictures. Always have. But I honestly couldn't figure out what he was talking about. Now, you have to remember, back in his days, there weren't any personal computers yet. The notion that you could move a mouse or a stylus down here while looking up here and not get confused, people found hard to believe. And I used to spend 15 minutes of every talk telling people that was really not a problem, that it was a very natural thing to do. In fact, your hand wasn't in the way. It was quite nice. Okay. So I was being a professor at NYU. Dick was building this whatever it was out in California. And then I broke my leg skiing. And I was in a full body cast for 3 months. Nipples exposed. Completely helpless. But it turned out to be one of the best times of my life. I could do nothing but think. And I'm still astonished at how much of our brain is taken up with just moving the body around. You turn that off, that need off, and it's just this vast cavern. Thought space opens up. And I had a wonderful time in there for 3 months. I thought about everything. I decided I'd done professoring. I'd done it. I didn't even like cellular automata theory anymore. And I wasn't doing anything about my art. So I resolved, while I was lying in bed, to drop out of academia and go to California where I knew something good would happen. And today I'm astonished, you know, now that I'm raising teenage boys, at how impulsive I was. That I just knew something good was going to happen. A little more context, this is the Vietnam War time, and I felt like I was training people for the war, and I didn't like that association, and I wasn't using my art. So I get out to California, and basically I'm a hippie in Berkeley during this time. And I'm bumming off rooms off friends, and run out of money finally. And I get a job offer to write a survey of cellular automata theory as the introduction to the German edition of John von Neumann's Self-Free Reducing Machines book. So I went, great. It had money attached to it. Right? So I'll write down my swan song, cellular automata theory, everything I know, get that off my, you know, that'll be the end of that era. I did that. I could write it all, you know, I was very fluent in the subject, I just wrote it off the top of my head, but I didn't have the definite references. I needed to go to the Stanford Library, Computer Science Library, with which I was very familiar. I knew it would have every reference I needed. So I called my buddy Dick up over on the other side of the bay. I said, can I bum a room off of you tonight so I can check out the library? Sure. So we do this. I go over, I do the library. We have a great time seeing each other. Next morning, he says, well, come over and see what I'm doing. And I felt obligated. He had put me up for the night. I said, well, I can only stay for a little short time. I got a lot of stuff happening back in Berkeley. You know, can't imagine what, but... Well, of course, what I saw blew my mind, as we said in those days. It was a machine for making art. It was exactly, couldn't have been anything more perfect for me. Art and computers together. And I knew that's what I had to do with my life. That was the thing I'd known was going to happen in California if I would just leave professorhood and go out there. So the next trick was to get hired at Xerox PARC. Now, I was a full, you know, hippie and full regalia in those years. Didn't really care about working with a large corporation, which may amuse you if you know my most recent employer. But I wanted access to that machine. I wanted to make art on that machine. I didn't care whether I had a job. I didn't care about the salary, any of that title. I just wanted to have access to that machine to make art on it. Dick wanted somebody to make art on it to show it off to the world. So he and Alan Kay and Bob Flagel and some other friends, I think Dave Liddell's in on that too, put together this scheme to get me inside. There were no slots to hire me with. So they hired me with a purchase order. Which I still have. Basically, it was a purchase order to come in and make art on this machine. So that's how I got in there. And worked very hard, made a piece called VidBits. You saw little bits of it. And I'm embarrassed by it now, so I asked it not to show very much of it. Which I later used to get me started in the art scene in New York City. So it was turned out to be a pretty interesting piece of video, even though I'm not sure the people at Xerox PARC completely appreciated it. I just want to say something. I think Dick is a little too modest. He says, you know, he wasn't the first paint program. There were other frame buffers before his and so forth. Yes, there were. But Super Paint was the first really serious artistic paint program with all the goodies, color maps and palettes and image transformations and image save and restore and video in and out and brush changing. You know, it was a full-blown thing. Yeah. Crude perhaps, but it had all the basics that are still in every modern paint program. And that's what he did first. Eventually, Xerox PARC made the decision not to do color. Which, of course, at the time I thought was an absolutely foolish thing of them to say, much less execute against. I argued that color was the future, and it was obvious, and they were in there first. But long story short, they pulled the rug out from under me and canceled my PO. Which I also have. In fact, I have a copy of it right down there. But before that happened, I met some interesting people, in addition to the very interesting people at Xerox PARC. A very, very important person I met during this time was David DeFrancisco, who was a video artist in San Francisco, who saw the demo of Super Paint and flipped out and had to have access to that machine. Did you know Dick Shout before he showed up? David Sharvin. David DeFrancisco? Yeah, okay. Sorry. By the way, Jim taught me my video. Very important contribution. David just hounded me for days, and he was so persistent that finally I said, okay, come over, and we'll spend the night jamming on Super Paint. It turns out he and I hit it off fabulously. because he loves technology and art. Okay? And in those days, this stuff was so tedious that you had to know where the technology was going to go or it would drive you insane. And he could see the future, so he just put up with the all that hard stuff. This Cratchit. Video tape machines that didn't do what you wanted. Things like that.
So he and I hit it off, and we decided to apply for a NEA, National Endowment for the Arts, grant to exploit this new medium, this new artistic medium. We knew it was a new medium, no question about it. David needed a job. He never got hired at Xerox PARC. He was just coming in at night playing with me. And he said, I said, I don't want to write a proposal. See, my experience with writing proposals was at the National Science Foundation, where the proposal would be 40 pages thick, half of it financials, and you would submit in 20 for it. No joke. He says, oh, no. NEA, you submit one page and your work. So that's what we did. We cast our lots together thereby because we needed this new medium, frame buffer, to execute our art. So that's when Xerox came in and said, nope, you're out of here. Well, David and I said, well, what are we going to do? We have to go to find the next frame buffer. And the next one was being built in Utah by Evans and Sutherland. So we went there, and I'm going to skip through this part pretty fast. We basically, they were Defense Department funded at University of Utah, and they couldn't use the A word, art, around them. In fact, they did lose their funding for artistic things, as I recall. But we picked up one very interesting piece of information, and that was that this madman, Alex Schur, from New York Institute of Technology, came through here and bought everything in sight, one of every piece of equipment, and he has 100 animators from Hollywood out there on this estate on Long Island, and he's going to make animated movie. You should check him out. Okay, sure. Martin Newell, whom some of you may know because of his teapot, which is in the computer room right here, was at the University of Utah, and he said, look, I'm going to go out to New York Tech next week, and I'll call you when I get back and tell you what the scene there is. Well, what he said was, when he made the phone call to us, was, if I were you, I'd get on the next plane. So that's what I did. I spent my last money in the world and got on the plane. David and I got on this plane, actually, to stay with his father in New Jersey to visit this Uncle Alex. The reason I call him Uncle Alex is because one of the biggest coincidences of my life that I still don't understand is this. While working with Dick on Super Paint, I was living up in Los Altos Hills at a house with Richard and Sandra. He's the roommate. I came back from my first visit to New York Tech, one I'm just about to tell you now. All excited. I'd just seen the future. It was exciting. I could talk art. This guy was going to make movies. This was it. And, wait a minute. I'm telling this in the wrong order. First, Richard had gone to New York for a family holiday, and he'd come back tell me about this uncle of his doing what I do. He says, he's doing the same thing you're doing, Albie. What do you know? He's an economist. He doesn't know what he's talking about. Because I thought we probably knew everything in the world. Everybody in the world who was doing computer graphics, we probably would have heard about just through the grapevine. We heard of this guy. So, I make the trip out to New York Tech. I meet this fabulous Uncle Alex, this fabulous Alex Schur. Come back and I'm telling my roommates all about this wonderful guy. And Richard, that's when he says, Albie, I've been trying to tell you, that's my uncle. Which has still got to be one of the most bizarre things of all. So we called him Uncle Alex, not to his face. We called him Alex to his face, but Uncle Alex amongst ourselves for the whole time we were in New York Tech, which was about 5 or 6 years. I did go out there. It was as advertised. Alex Shearer was a creative madman. He didn't quite know what he had. I call him an accidental visionary. He knew that this was going to be the future. He just had his timing off quite a bit. He also